Everybody, welcome to another episode of the OIG Roundtable with my two partners in crime here, Wade McFall, retired assistant special agent in charge from the LA field office and our manager on our SI investigative team, and Matt Kachansky, the retired special agent in charge, special investigations branch of the OIG, retired Northeast UPIC director, and now our payment integrity director. So today we want to talk about a press release that came out, I think the end of last week, kind of interesting, involving a personal care aid and Medicaid payments. This personal care aide pleaded guilty to some fraud relating to submitting claims for services that didn't occur. And the interesting thing that kind of stands out is the fact that we're talking about a case that involved $12,000. And what kind of sparked our interest was $12,000 doesn't usually bat much of an eye. But, you know, one of the things that you always have to consider is that a $12,000 case in Omaha, Nebraska, might be the functional equivalent of a $200,000 or $300,000 case in a larger metropolitan city. We do, as part of our SIU investigative team, we have contracts where we are overseeing Medicaid SIU work in very similarly situated environments, some smaller states and some lower population states, where cases that are $10,000, $12,000 are not really unheard of from the payment integrity SIU space. But what makes this an interesting case is that it's personal care services, which have some inherent weaknesses built into them. Generally speaking, family members can provide those services and get paid for them at the end of their shift. And so that has an inherent weakness right into it, because who's to say that the family member is actually rendering those services? And then equally as important is, if they're not, who's going to report that, because you're providing those services to a family member? But it does present some interesting things. And Wade, you're working on actually one of those contracts in one of the smaller states where the population is not great. And you've done a lot of these cases, and you've done a lot of these cases that involve also things like adult medical daycare and things of that sort, where the documentation is not voluminous. But obviously the thing is that a $12,000 case could take as much time as a several hundred thousand dollar upcoding case, right? Because part of it is you have to look through the documents and do your investigation. And I know we've talked about this on previous podcasts, that the amount of time that one needs to spend conducting their investigation isn't inherently tied to the dollar value ascribed to the fraud, waste, abuse issue at hand. So Wade, you know, from personal experience of having worked on these cases over the past couple of years in the adult space, adult daycare, but even in the home visits with electronic visit verification or EVV, the challenges that exist, because it may not be that the case is necessarily more or less difficult, but it's time, right? It's a volume of documents that really require an investigator to schedule out what's there, what's not there. And so from a time perspective, looking at a case and saying $12,000 shouldn't raise an eyebrow versus a case that is $300,000 any differently.
Right, and a couple things there that you mentioned I addressed, but the EVV system is set up so that there's an electronic, basically an electronic signature that when a personal care aide goes to a residence, it automatically uses GPS and different technology, but it shows, it's basically an electronic check-in, so there's a record of when they arrived there, what the location is. Then they have to go ahead and do some manual checking on like the services they provided. Maybe they check a box that says I've, you know, provided meals, I've done various things for hygiene, whatever. But then it also shows when they leave. So there's at least almost something that's not really refutable, that they showed up at this time and then they were there for a certain amount of time. But there's also alternates for that one, because there's a couple different variations on EVV. Some use cell phone technology, some use like a key fob that's installed in the residence. There's different variations. Some use just an 800 number that the aide can call in and it shows that they were there from this time. But one that there's not coverage, electronic coverage or whatever, for whatever reason, they can't use EVV. It goes back to the old, it's like a timesheet where you're manually writing in where you are, what time you arrived, what you did, when you left, all those things. And that's where a lot of the fraud comes in. If it's manually checking you in and checking you out and listing the address, it's hard to get around that. You're either there or you weren't. You can show up and not do the work you're supposed to be doing, but it at least at a minimum shows that you arrived and departed at certain times. Once you get these cases, and a lot of them where they're what I suspect in this case is where she's not showing up, it's probably not an EVV related case. It's going to be a handwritten timesheet. So now the investigation, like you said, it's a $12,000 versus a several hundred thousand dollars. A lot of the steps are still the same. You have to go through these handwritten notes, try and decipher the handwriting to see what they say, which can be tricky. A lot of times you're going to see photocopied or copied and pasted signatures, or even the notes, you can compare them side by side and it's clearly a photocopy. There's, you kind of get into some handwriting analysis almost and show that these are photocopies of the same note just used over and over. So the time that has to go into that case for, like you say, a $12,000 case as opposed to several hundred thousand dollars is going to be the same time commitment for arguably, depending on how you look at it, arguably a smaller case. But as you pointed out, there are cases where if it's a smaller SIU, maybe the cases generally are $20,000 or, or less. So you have to kind of prioritize what you have available to work in. That, like you said, that might be a viable case that you're going to put some time into it. Another reason that it's important, even though the overpayment amount may not be substantial, if you get to the point where you've worked the case and you've shown, as in this case, that this person wasn't conducting the visits, wasn't doing the work, now they've been put on notice. So you, looking down the line, you can say, look, she knows what she was doing was wrong. We've educated them on, even if it's not as egregious as this, once we work a smaller case and we educate them on what they've done wrong, now another year or two down the line, if we go back and pull their data and look at it, if they're doing the same thing that we educated them on before that they were convicted on or pled guilty to, there's that critical element that we always talk about, is that intent element that goes out the window because we've shown that they know it was wrong, they were educated, and they're doing it anyway. So that's another area that all of them, the overpayment money may not be as high as others, it's still got value for deterrent factors really down the road.
And that may be true, but there's also, the side part of it is that because of, for example, in the CMS space, the targeted probe and education, where providers are given multiple opportunities to continue to be fraudulent and not have action taken against them, right? So there sometimes there have to be some other factors in there outside of just that education piece, because we see that providers get educated multiple times, and sometimes CMS doesn't want to pull the trigger and make that referral over there because of that. And the challenge, I think, in the personal care services space is we've seen plenty of cases that the OIG has worked on where some of these personal care aides are working for multiple organizations and they're billing for 40 hours at each one. And, I think I saw a case a year or two ago where a personal care aide made something like $300,000 in salary because they, hourly rate, they're working at three or four places. And the problem is that when those claims are submitted, they're not submitted with who the actual aide is, right? And that may be an overall program weakness, that the name of the person has to be there, because that would theoretically allow the payers to be able to see what the story is. Because ultimately, at the end of the day, unless you know that Wade McFall is working at three places and have the ability from a law enforcement perspective to pull wage reports and things of that sort, sometimes the challenge of putting those pieces together, because there's no centralized database for these aides. And, we know from working these cases that the turnover is very high and that people leave on a frequent basis on these things. So these are kind of things that may become collateral parts of an investigation. And so, Matt, from a managerial perspective and from that overall payment integrity, I think when you look at a case that's $12,000, we would say, I don't know if I ever worked a case that was $12,000 in my OIG time, and I know here, I've not done anything that, but from the payment integrity perspective, we see cases that are not every case is a $1 million case, and what may be considered a small dollar amount to some may be a large dollar amount to others, and a lot of it isn't. It's not just about, telling an investigator to work something or not work something, but a little bit of it is the pitch. There were some other factors involving this particular defendant, right? And where she should have or should not have been allowed to go. And that becomes a plus factor from an investigative perspective. If you're making a pitch to the mafuku, you may have uncovered some facts that make a $12,000 case a little more attractive.
Oh, absolutely. I won't say that money doesn't matter, because it absolutely does. The size of the overpayment does matter. It is a factor in every case, and does raise the priority of it as the money goes up. But there are other factors involved. Are the beneficiaries and the members at risk? Of course, if it's quality of care, neglect, things like that, that raises the priority of it. Are there other factors involved in terms of, is this person's conduct going across different agencies? Is it, is the how widespread is it? And that just so happens that it got caught quickly, that type of thing keeps the dollars small. And so with this one, all I'm going on is a press release. It says the perpetrator, the defendant, had been banned and barred from the place of service where these services supposedly took place. It's a housing project in Omaha. What could she have done to be banned and barred from that place and still then be able to bill for the services? So there is obviously some facts behind the money, aside from the money, that allowed this mafuku to take an interest in this thing. And
Well,
so
let
that's,
me ask this, Matt. So, I mean, a couple of things. One, if you're an SIU investigator and you're looking at this case for whatever reason, right? Like speaking to the people that are the members of the plan for which these claims were submitted, like that's going to be an important piece of the puzzle. Like interviewing the members is a super important piece of this puzzle, because you're going to have an instance where maybe this individual has billed for Monday through Friday for 4 hours, and you get on the phone with the member, and the member says, "Well, I was away with my family," or something like that, right?
Well, we did a lot of these at the UPIC, and it was, going to the adult living facility. You talk to each of the members. We would even bring pictures of the providers and say, "Is this the person providing the service?" And we'd also talk to the administrative offices in those places. This is, is there a sign-in sheet where this person comes in? Did you recognize this person? How often do they come in? Maybe that's how they found out that she's banned and barred. She hasn't been in here in however long. And then
It's
it's a
like
simple
old school,
case.
as you call old school
Gumshoe.
gumshoeing. Yeah,
Yeah.
gumshoeing. Like you're out there
Absolutely.
gumshoeing. But Matt, you brought up a good point, which is the quality of care. And I think there's two things that I want to kind of get your opinion on. The first one is that with something like personal care services, if she is billing for personal care services for a member that's not actually getting them, and then that member actually needs to get those services, that's going to present a problem, coupled with the fact that there might be limitations on the cost. Like, back in the day with physical therapy, where we would see cases where a physical therapist would fraudulently bill for PT services, and there was a threshold. You can't get paid more than X number of services, and those are fraudulent. And then lo and behold, the member, the Medicare beneficiary, whomever actually needs that physical therapy or these personal care services. And the problem has always been, how do you rectify the individual member's account with the payer? Right? So this lady is out there billing for personal care services for members that aren't getting them, and then the member actually needs them. And then the organization, the agency, submits a claim and it gets rejected for plan thresholds. And you're like, well, how do you rectify that, right? So, you know, those are important pieces that I think at the end of the day become backstories that are equally as important, because quality of care can intrinsically be connected to fraud, waste, abuse.
Oh, absolutely. You think about these, however many people, it was three people in this one particular building. Those services were ordered by a physician because a physician deemed that person needed them for their health and welfare. You know, whether it's they can't clean themselves, they can't cook, it's a danger for them to cook meals for themselves, whatever it might have been, they needed this care that was not being provided by them. And what, to your point, you know, that goes beyond like personal care service, physical therapy, DME equipment. You know, oh, I bill them for electronic, you know, in a electric wheelchair. They only get one of those. So it's almost like having your identity stolen. You know, how do I prove I didn't spend that? You know, I didn't use the credit card. You spend months and years of your life trying to get those things back in order. It's the same for these members trying to say, I didn't get this. I didn't receive these services. And what do they have to show that? It's an uphill battle for them to be able to say, I didn't get these services. I didn't get this equipment. I didn't get these supplies. So why am I hitting this cap? Because the numbers show that you did get them. And other than a longstanding, you know, effort from someone in an SIU, those facts are going to stay those facts until they're proven otherwise through something like this, you know, criminal conviction. So it's to the, however small the loss is, the gain to the beneficiary from having these things resolved is huge for their health and well-being.
Right. So this is one of those examples where there may be an issue in provision of services. And I think, you know, the part that I think people sometimes tend to not think about is that if the member needs home care services and there's a capitated amount that you can get, this is creating a collateral problem where how do you rectify it? The plan has to go back and essentially agree to a reset for something, right? Because if that's the case, and I think, you know, that's part of it, is that when you get these cases where there's an overpayment, there has to be, if it's not a Mufuku case or a law enforcement case, but there needs to be some impetus for when you've got something that has like a plan limitation, yep, that there be the ability to do a reset. And I think even more so, you know, like in this case, for example, whoever the affected payers were, even if they don't see a penny of this money, because we all know that the amount of money that is alleged versus the amount of money that's recuperated and restitution. And what if this person doesn't have $12,000 and they're paying back, you know, $5 a month for the rest of their natural life or something ridiculous like that? Because we've seen these instances, or it just becomes an uncollectible amount of restitution. The plan may still ultimately, unfortunately, be out the actual cash because of the perpetuation of the fraud. But the collateral consequence is that the plan needs to recalibrate and basically credit back the member, because if in fact this member does need those services, they're not able to get them. And I think, you know, one of the other collateral things is there's a lot of talk right now about what's going on in government with respect to reductions in Medicaid payments. And this could be something where there is that direct collateral consequence that as a result of it, there's less money. And with less money become sometimes reductions in services. And so when you've got the neediest and the poorest of people needing something, you know, the plan has to ultimately say, right, we're this money's gone. You know, unless this person has $12,000 in an account that hasn't been frozen or seized or substitute assets, you know, even if you're paying it back at a rate of $50 a month, this is years in the making where the plan isn't really getting their money back. So there are some collateral consequences from these kinds of cases. I remember very specifically having a case when I was in our last world, where there was, I believe at the time, it was something like a $700 cap for physical therapy in a calendar year. And you see it now, even in the commercial space, we see cases, right? You can only get PT for so many services a year. And I remember an instance where this one particular provider had billed to the cap for the Medicare reimbursement, but the services had never been rendered. You know, the patient never got them. And about 3 or 4 months afterwards, or some period of time within that calendar year, an actual Medicare beneficiary needed physical therapy, and it was being denied. And it was because the cap had been hit. This provider had maxed out the reimbursements. And what do you do? This patient this individual had something that required them to actually go for physical therapy. And it was a challenge because there has to be a recalibration. CMS has to get involved. At the time, it was either the ZPIC or the PSC, the fiscal intermediary or the carrier. Like, the number of moving parts to fix this problem was unsurmountable. To be able to get it to essentially get their account brought back to zero so that their actual physical therapy can go on. And I think, unfortunately, the bad guys don't care, oh. Right? They don't care. And in the SIU and the payment integrity space, I think this is where having those conversations with other departments, utilization management, enrollment, provider relations, whatever it may be, but certainly utilization management needs to get involved into these discussions with payment integrity and all of that, because these do become kind of collateral pieces of the puzzle to fix. They're not our things to fix, but in our current life that we live, when we're doing our consulting and advisory work and our SIU management, these are things that have to come up in conversations, because it is something that I think sometimes maybe the payers aren't really thinking about. Okay, when they do this, it's going to lead to that, because it really is a domino effect. There really is a Boolean logic to it. So it is interesting, but I do think the take home for me is $12,000 may be a small dollar amount, but there are huge collateral consequences that occur from that $12,000. But also, I think from the SIU investigator's perspective, and Wade, I'll give you the last laugh on this, so to say, is, you know, you work on a case and it's $12,000, and there's, I think, nothing worse than spending your time and effort and energy on something. It's $12,000 and saying, I can't believe this is $12,000. What do I do with it? And depending upon where you are, right, that's where those relationships matter. Having those conversations with knowing, and maybe the pitch, right? So last hurrah on that kind of a case is, you know, $12,000 may not be a lot, but Do you pitch it with a little bit of a different spin?
Yeah, I think just as Matt was going over, as long as the hierarchy of people you report to, and that, you know, pay our company to do the SIU work, as long as they are aware of the other collateral effects of a small dollar case, they have to look at the big picture, and it's doing what it's supposed to do in the big picture. The end result of money at the year might be lower, and that is something they always look at. But as long as we try and, I'll say, educate them, but talk about the other collateral effects of an investigation, like Matt's been talking about for the last few minutes, as long as we try and get that across to them and they understand that, they should be fine with a few cases that are a smaller dollar amount that have still had a lasting effect for the members.
And I will say, you never know what cases get accepted. I mean, at the UPIC,
right,
just recently in one of our other contracts, we presented three cases to the state, Mifuku, a $10 million case, a $250,000 case, and a $3,000 case. They took the $3,000 case.
Yeah. And that's just because sometimes the facts, right? And a little bit of it is, when you've got a smaller Mifuku, and there are lots of states with small Mifukus or ineffective Mifukus, for whatever reason, sometimes a $3,000 case, which is a home run, is an easier thing that they'll take versus the $1 million case that has some complexities, some policy differentiations. You know, one of the biggest things is the policy or is the guidance a little gray? Is it not really clear? You know, and unfortunately, we could have a whole separate conversation about this because we see this with CMS policies all the time. We see it in the program integrity manual all the time that things aren't black and white. And a lot of these things can be seen in two different ways. And those two different ways, neither can be wrong or both can be wrong, because it's depending upon who's looking at it. So yeah, that's where those relationships are an important piece of the puzzle. So interesting case. The take home is $12,000 is still a fraud on the Medicaid program. And it was great to see that this case got resolved in a positive way. And so, you know, these press releases sometimes give you avenues and opportunities to think about how internally you're going to deal with, what if we had a $12,000 case? Because I think a lot of SIUs don't think in those terms. What if we had a $12,000 case and it involved capitation on, you know, limits on payments and things of that sort? So these kinds of cases should be food for thought, if not creating actionable routes for how you're going to deal with things. So good case, good conversation as always. As always, for those that tune in, we appreciate everybody that tuned in. Again, get the newsletter every Friday right to your inbox, right through LinkedIn, right through your email, advise, advise.com. And until next week, we'll see you on the next OIG Roundtable. Take care, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you all.